Welcome to the Buyer's Desk, your weekly resource for all things natural food retail.
This season, we're shaking things up with shorter weekly episodes to fit your busy schedule.
Each month, we dive into SPINS data, explore trends with industry leaders, spotlight emerging brands, and share actionable strategies to help you thrive.
Get ready to explore the world of natural food retail.
Hey, folks, and thanks for tuning in today. I am Chris Sorensen.
And I'm Angela Bozo, and we are your hosts.
And we're so grateful for all of you who've been with us over the past 3 years of the Buyer's Desk.
And a big welcome to those of you who just joined us this year as we shifted to shorter weekly episodes.
So today, we're digging into the archives to bring back some of our favorite conversations served up in that shorter format.
Thanks for listening, and keep tuning in each week for more stories and maybe even a few sneak peeks at season 4 coming in January 2026.
Hey, folks, and welcome to the Buyer's Desk. My name is Chris Sorensen.
And I'm Angela Bozo, and we are your hosts.
And today we're talking leadership, but not the corporate kind of bland mission statements and corner offices. We're talking about leading with values, vision, and a whole lot of guts.
Our guest is someone who's redefined what a CEO can be. He calls himself the Cosmic Engagement Officer, and he's living up to it.
David Bronner of Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps isn't just making suds, he's making waves, because under his leadership, the company has become a beacon for ethical business with radical transparency, capped executive pay, plant-based lunches, and psychedelic policy reform, and a leadership style that maybe is a little bit more Burning Man than boardroom.
We're going to dig into just how that works in real life, what's working, what's hard, and how it could inspire other retailers and brands to lead with purpose, not just profit.
Bam.
Welcome. Yeah, welcome, David. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, right on. Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, that was awesome. That was pretty much the best introduction ever, so...
Oh, man.
Awesome. Yeah. That means a lot.
Yeah.
Well, David, I think we kick right into this. I want to know more about the Cosmic Engagement Officer. I think it's like one of the greatest job titles I've ever heard, but I want to know what that means to you. Like, how did you come up with that? And how does that guide the way you show up as a leader at Dr. Bronner's?
Yeah. So, I mean, the actual answer would be it was past time to promote my brother, company president, Mike Bronner, to president. He'd been VP for, 15 plus years. And I had, had president and CEO. I never used a CEO. I was just a president. It was time for him to become president. And I didn't particularly like CEO just because of the, connotation and business, whatever. And Mike came up with Ryan, our VP of the PR, Cosmic Engagement Officer. And and I think it just kind of resonates to probably the most in my family. I resonate to my granddad, Dr. Bronner, his kind of cosmic vision and his passion to unite humanity across religious and ethnic divides. And, we're all children of the same divine source. And, if we don't realize that transcendent unity, in the nuclear armed world, my granddad saw that we would all perish. And I didn't really understand what he was talking about growing up until I had some pretty massive psychedelic experiences and died into the love and light at the heart of existence that somehow is true in the midst of all the suffering and absurdity. And it is all God self in the mystery of things. And we're here, that incarnate part of God self that can, work to end the oppression and suffering that we rain down on each other. And I mean, there's always going to be, accidents and tragedies of the natural kind, but the kind that we inflict on each other, we can, collectively liberate and one day, live in peace and harmony and celebrate each other's, own most soulful uniqueness and just be, totally supportive and awesome and create that kind of heaven on earth society. So I'm like kind of, the eternal optimist, even though obviously we've got a lot of evidence to the contrary, the current administration and world events, but, just taking the long view of, the generational time, 7 generations, it's just, I think we're on a pretty amazing trajectory, even as dark as it can be. So, but anyways, I would say that's where that Cosmic Engagement Officer came from.
Yeah. And it sounds like just hearing you talk in that way too, sounds like you really bring a whole other like view to just leadership. So like, how does like thinking about your worldview, your connection to your grandfather and all of that, how does that connect you to the work of like leading this team at Dr. Bronner's and leading other people and guiding other people in this business?
Right on. Well, you know, that aforementioned, you know, psychedelic experience, and I've had many, but the real big initiation, it was very clear that we're here to serve. And, you know, that's our purpose, is to, you know, make the world as awesome as possible. And money is, you know, is a tool, is a force that should be deployed for the good of all and not just to be amassed. And kind of the metaphor of the dragon can be awesome. I mean, obviously Kundalini dragons and stuff, but the, you know, there's also like the kind of dark dragon that just hoards and just takes the wealth of the world, just hoards it and doesn't do anything with it. You know, we're here to flow it and power up allies who are doing really good work in the world. And so, yeah, so, you know, just obviously we need to run a good business and, you know, make the best soap and best products and at a good price point, you know, hit the quality specs and, you know, do all that, but do it in a way that's to the benefit of all stakeholders. And, you know, and obviously our workforce and leadership is a key stakeholder. So we make sure we're paying, you know, good wages and benefits, but then capping the top salaries at the top that, you know, kind of were, you know, my granddad founded our company as a nonprofit religious organization. And at some point the IRS disagreed with his self-designated tax exempt status. And he was in bankruptcy and my parents got involved at that point and Uncle Ralph and helped right the ship and exit bankruptcy as a for-profit, but we've got that nonprofit DNA, the heart of what we do. And, you know, and I think that we've been able to attract like really amazing people who are willing, you know, in a way when you like join like a nonprofit, it's just understood you're not, you know, you're trading like your income for mission, you know, and purpose and impact. So like we, you know, kind of have, you know, kind of thread a line, kind of like a social venture or benefit corp. And yeah, so, you know, just taking care of our, you know, rank and file people and then capping it at the top and enabling us to, so, you know, pay fair, you know, be fair trade in our supply chains, like, you know, make sure all our major raw materials are being grown in a way to the benefit of the farmers and the workers and the communities involved and not to their detriment, going to market in partnership with them and not playing them off, you know, like who's got the cheapest, you know, source of coconut or palm oil or, you know, some really problematic raw materials that we use. And there's nothing inherently bad about them, but the way they're generally grown is horrendous. And I would just say you know, it's a little bit of a dark analogy, but it came up yesterday and dinner. But that in some ways, Genghis Khan, obviously, we're not about like dominating the world or anything, but he did have a philosophy of like kind of giving his khans a lot of power, you know, just saying like, hey, like, you know, if you're, and I feel like in Bronner's, we kind of have like a lot of khans that are doing, a lot of righteous stuff. So the leader, you know, I'm not like super on top of everybody. I mean, sometimes obviously you got to be, but, you know, but for the most part, we've just got amazing people and just like, okay, well, you know, I feel like my major talent is knowing something well enough to know who can do it way better, you know, and like kind of finding those people and they find me and find my, you know, and we just come together in this kind of awesome way and got an amazing executive council of our leadership. You know, we do things very collaboratively, really try to build consensus. Kind of very rarely do we make a major decision without like getting that consensus. I mean, not always, you know, but that's always the goal. And yeah, and you know, everyone's bought into our mission that, you know, it would be really problematic if, you know, our family ownership was, you know, a lot of mission-driven companies just either within their own families or with bringing in non-aligned financing and partners, just the mission gets all whipsawed. And fortunately we've been able to, you know, navigate that and you know, not suffer the fate of many mission driven brands that where that happens. And then they're, you know, they got investors that are all, you know, very exit oriented and like you gotta, you know, put up these numbers and, you know, and then it's just like, you know, the mission just goes sideways quick. So yeah. So I would say you know, it's a, you know, shared leadership. Very much I try to be humble, servant leader, you know, don't always get that right, but that's the goal.
But if you try, right? Sometimes it's just, some people don't try.
Yeah, no, totally. There's some really obnoxious, obviously, you know, maybe even the default is a much more obnoxious style of leadership. But I mean, there are, you know, companies we really admire and what they've been able to do from the, you know, Equal Exchanges and Guayaquil and, you know, the Nature's Path, you know, there's some really amazing models out there. And yeah, and yeah, just trying to set a different vibration for how we can go to market and be in business.
I love this. I very much resonate with service as a purpose. I also hear you talk to me about the connectiveness of all humans, right? And there's something that you said when you answered that leadership question that I'm wondering if I'm right about. You've obviously met other people in this space that care a great deal. You've met other people in this space that have very valid, beautiful missions. I would argue that one of the things that really sets you apart is thinking about how many different shareholders are actually, right? Like, it's not just your employees. It is not just the people that are providing the raw materials. I feel like in listening to you, you are thinking about a very expansive, like, group of stakeholders. Am I right? Does this resonate? It's bigger?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. In fact, the term we often use is, we call it constructive capitalism, or we call it multi-stakeholder. Well, I guess others call it multi-stakeholder capitalism. But yeah, you take account, you go to market, you take account of the earth and your environmental impact, take account of your supply chain integrity, you know, where a lot of abuses happen, you know, like any consumer product, agricultural-based product. I mean, is cool as whatever we do in our headquarters and our factory here in Vista in Southern California, like 95%+ of our impact in terms of workers and farmers and number of people in terms of the land base is in our supply chain. And you gotta like really attend to that, because that's where things really kind of, that's where most of the harms of, you know, business as usual occur. And yeah, of course our workers, and then our community, you know, and just like, you know, rather than buying yachts for our executives or our executive buying yachts with excessive bonuses, you know, we cap that and make sure we're giving back to the causes and organizations, you know, here around town, but then also nationally and globally that are engaging on, you know, crucial issues.
And how hard is that? I mean, do people come to you and ask you for leadership and it like kind of mentor advice where you really want to delve into like the complicated questions of taking care of everyone in the supply chain? Like, how hard?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, because we are launching real time, or we're in the pilot of what we're calling the Purpose Pledge. And we being us and I think 20, well, altogether 20 brands are in this pilot, including Nature's Path and Yerba Madre now, not Guayaquil, and Nature's Path, and, you know, some really awesome Equal Exchange, you know. So, you know, a lot of these companies that really have been modeling these kind of practices, like coming together and like around 10 commitment areas of like supply chain integrity, living wages, carbon neutrality, you know, I'm really trying to define this in a way that's meaningful and achievable, and, you know, and giving enough time to achieve. So it's like a 10-year time window, with 3-year tranches, and yeah, we're really refining the model and refining the expectations, and, you know, we want to, yeah, set a real high bar and, but also make it workable and sensible. And we have exciting NGO partners in each of these commitment areas, like Living Wage for US is, working with us on the living wage and True Certification on zero waste. And I forget exactly our climate change partner, but they're awesome. And just kind of working it out in a way that hopefully by Expo West next year, we'll be, you know, ready to launch the program for everybody. And, you know, and we, you know, had some issues with B Corp, primarily around the lack of requirements for eco-social certification of supply chain, you know, that was always an issue, but then became really problematic with various multinationals coming into the program, and you know, they're directionally going in a better direction, but still have a ways to go in our opinion. But yeah, that, you know, and we want to keep a friendly vibration, even though we did leave and make, you know, kind of make our point. We have plenty of allies that remain B Corp certified, including probably like half our pilot companies and Purpose Pledge. You want to be in good, you know, kind of inside outside game a bit, but yeah, that supply chain piece is crucial, and especially with these big multinationals, and yeah, so.
Well, for what it's worth, I appreciate you navigating the complexity. You know, I think a lot of times the fact that there are so many stakeholders and there are so many things to consider, and, you know, like, are we valuing our water consumption, or are we choosing to, you know, look at electrical input, and how do we balance that, can be really hard. And I just see you fight that good fight.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, I know. And we want to, you know, we're, you know, the Fighting Soap Company, and we're pretty activist, but we try to be, how do you say, fair, you know, not just like throw grenades, but, like, you know, just, you know, try to work it as much as we can. But then at a certain point, it's like, all right, you know, got to kind of take a stand here.
Yeah, David, I really love hearing you talk about even the purpose pledge. You know, I think about regenerative organic certified, and it's all about, like, setting this higher bar, doing all the things that are right, adding all of these, you know, pillars and other factors that maybe we're missing, right? So to try to get this stuff right. But I also think about this through the lens of leadership. You know, obviously, you're leading the way in a lot of ways around these certifications to try to get other people and bring people other along. So you lead a lot within the industry. You lead within your own company. And sometimes this showing up with heart and doing things the right way can be difficult. I know I try to show up the best I can for my employees and for the people here at Infra, and some days are harder than others. Some challenges that come in front of you are, like, can put your values on the line or can put your character on the line. And you have to find out, like, how do I move forward from this? So I want to know from you, like, how do you, David Bronner, get past some of those challenges? Like, when you're faced with some of these situations, when it's like the reality of a situation comes up, I think I have a feeling of how you approach it, but I want other people to hear, like, how do you approach those situations, and how can you kind of advise other business owners on, like, how to use the David Bronner vibration to approach these kind of situations?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to just shout out Les Sabo on our team. Our chief impact and strategy officer has really been point driving purpose pledge on our team. And it's been a whole collaboration. And thank you for bringing up regenerative organic. That's, you know, a huge effort. Also, you know, really cuts across a lot of our activism, you know, bringing together a high level criteria around soil health and pasture based animal welfare, livestock, and fair labor into a single consumer facing standard. So instead of having your fair trade and your animal welfare and your soil health certs, you know, it's all one program, and really, really stoked by this and really getting traction. And, you know, I mean, like every business, we've had, you know, some real crises in our trajectory, but, you know, also opportunities. You know, how do you navigate those? And one was, we had our first big fair trade project or direct project. You know, we realized organic was great, but it didn't give us visibility into the social conditions. And, you know, we realized we need to establish direct trading relationships, you know, inspired by the models of Guayaquil and Equal Exchange. Like, we need to do this with our raw material supply chains. And one of our first grew out of a tsunami relief project in Sri Lanka. And one thing led to another. And we helped set up a sister company to produce our coconut oil. That's our number one ingredient. And at the time, it was set up with a food brand partner, a VCO partner, who was going to take the food grade oil. And then we were going to take kind of like the cosmetic, you know, like, it was just kind of an elegant deal. But then, like, the whole situation in Sri Lanka with the civil war and just drought and all kinds of stuff. And the prices, like, tripled, you know. And we were in a region, we had a diverse workforce. We had both Sinhalese and Tamil, and, you know, like, a Muslim gentleman was actually part of the leadership. It was a really good, and actually Sonali is our, so it was Gordon and Sonali, and Sonali actually converted to Islam to marry her husband. And she's the head of Sarnapol. And interestingly enough, in Sarnapol in Ghana, it's also a mixed Christian Muslim country, you know, like 80% Christian, but Safiyanu himself is Muslim. And then our olive oil comes predominantly from Canaan Fair Trade in the West Bank of Palestine. Nasser Abu Far is Muslim. And, you know, and then the balance comes from the Israeli side, half from a Jewish family farm, half from a Palestinian Christian project. So, you know, but it's interesting that that's an interesting cool one vibration we got going on. But anyway, so all of a sudden, price of coconut, you know, triples. And our food partner bails, understandably. They're like, yeah, that's not going to work for us. And then, you know, so we're just like, well, this is not going to work at all. Like, you know, like this whole project is set up, like we need a VCO, like outlet. And I remember just like, remember shouting with Gary Lassone, who's our VP of special operations, and set up, you know, that project with our team. We've got an amazing team of that sets up and works with our partner projects, our various agricultural projects around the world. Yeah, we were, you know, just really stressing, obviously. And I was like, you know, I was telling Gary, I was like, look, we could basically shut this down, give everyone 1 year severance, go into the Philippines, start over and make our money back in 1 year. You know, this doesn't make, you know, like this makes no sense, you know? And, you know, but then he's like, look, man, this is about relationships we built. You know, I mean, to do that, it's just like, that would just be so not great. And, you know, and so I guess maybe the lesson is like, you know, just being in the dilemma of it, you know, and just feeling it and allowing it, not, you know, not just, just being it. And then eventually we're like, well, we should launch our own VCO and our own brand. And so that was, you know, and that turned out to be just incredibly lucrative because it was just when VCO was exploding and, you know, it kind of went way up and then the hype, you know, whatever. I mean, we never said this, but like people out there saying, oh, you can like lose 100 pounds, you know, eating coconut oil, whatever. It was like ridiculous. I mean, coconut oil is awesome. It's a great, great oil, you know, high, it's beautiful. It's really great, but it's not as great as obviously people were saying. But anyways, you know, it turned out to be, you know, like a category that was, had very, relatively few brands in it. We could just hit it at the right time and it turned out great. Now, I'm not going to say like every single problem like that's going to have a happy ending, but, you know, but it's like, I would say just being in the dilemma, like actually really feeling the different tension and not just going the eat whatever way that's going to save you money. You know, I mean, sometimes you do need to cut your losses, you know, I mean, chocolate, like we're, you know what I mean? Like we kind of like got a little, you know, the VCO was kind of misleading in that it was like a unique kind of constellation of circumstance that enabled that to succeed. And, you know, and we had a kind of similar, like our palm farmers in Ghana are intercropping palm with cocoa, banana, and cassava, doing dynamic ag forestry, multi-strata ag forestry, which maximizes photosynthetic capture and biomass yield and minimizes weed and pest pressure versus like monocultures. And palm and cocoa are two of the world's most problematic crops. And we're showing how you can grow them together in this really awesome way. And we were helping sell the cocoa to European chocolatiers, and it kind of, you know, gotten relationships. And it you know, kind of came like, oh, well, we could really help our farmers with bringing our own branded chocolate. And Maestrani was our partner in Switzerland, their 5th generation amazing chocolatier. Yeah. And that was, unfortunately, I mean, it's the best chocolate. It's so dope. It's so great, but it's such a saturated, difficult category. And we realized that the brand, like, as strong as our brand positioning is, that ultimately, like, you know, what cereal company do you want making your shampoo, and, you know, what, you know, whatever lotion company do you want making your cereal? So like, it was just like too much of a stretch. And we just realized at a certain point that like, hey, this is not, you know, we're losing money, like this is not working out. And, but, you know, but then, okay, like, you know, how do we, you know, rather than just like cut it, you know, and just save as much money as possible, like we actually did like a really awesome transfer to, like, basically just gave it to Maestrani, who has that additional inside margin we were paying them and the capability to go global with the supply chain and really, like, you know, take this to another level and much more positioned to do it, you know? So it took, you know, obviously extra expense to do that, but now it's, you know, it's kind of got a rebrand. It's still got the magic chocolate and it's still in the market, and yeah, and it's awesome, but it's going to be able to go way further with this new home. And yeah, it would be like an example of like, okay, here's something that's not working out. We got to, you know, which this launched new products and categories a little more closely adjacent and sensible. And which, you know, we've got some exciting things in the pipeline. But yeah, it was a big lesson. You know, these are big lessons. And yeah, just try to like, yeah, sometimes what was the solution last time isn't the solution this time. And, you know, just always got to be ready to pivot and move, but always try to do it in a way that's, yeah, soft landing for the major stakeholders. And yeah.
Yeah, I know Angela's begging to ask you a question, but can I just have one follow-up on that, Angela?
Please. You go.
Okay. Because David, I think of like all of those situations, like I love how you guys handled them, how you talked about being in the tension, feeling it and thinking through that. I want to know the leadership piece of it. Like, how do you communicate with the team? How does all this happen throughout your team and the people at Bronner's? And yeah, how does like big changes or those kind of decisions? Because you talked a lot about how you guys collaborate and you guys make decisions together. Can you just talk a little bit about that piece of it within either one of those situations?
Yeah, probably chocolate, just because it's more recent. And in this case, the communication strategy was really driven by Ryan Fletcher, our VP of PR, working closely with our CMO, Christina Valghese, and Christina really leading our internal kind of communication plan, and Ryan the external, but working closely together. And yeah, I would say there was like, you know, kind of phase communications, you know, like once we realized what was going on, it's like, okay, well, we don't want to just demoralize everybody with just a, hey, this isn't, you know, so like kind of like, you know, working to put things in place and, you know, kind of like doing a kind of planned series of communications to stakeholders over, you know, a planned time frame that ultimately worked out really good. Or maybe a couple hiccups where it's like, oh, we should have probably informed this person here, not here, you know, whatever. But
it sounds like your teams seem pretty informed and pretty on board, because like you talked about how people are connected to the mission. So it sounds like even within Dr. Bronner's, you guys have like a really good communication structure is what I'm hearing. And so you have the support of the people, and the leadership structure really seems to be all around communication and like togetherness as well. Like, this isn't a decision that you just did, that you and your brothers did. This is like,
no,
people were a part of this.
Yeah, exactly. And our, you know, our executive council is, you know, basically it's all of our directors and above. And I think it's like 15 strong now. And we meet once a quarter in person, you know, and obviously within, you know, I think there's, you know, our financial meetings, monthly financial meetings, we're all circled up, and that's when we, you know, put whatever on the agenda to deal with. But yeah, we do try to like, you know, work things out collectively, collaboratively. You know, some things are obviously easier than others.
I did not have a question. I wanted to tell you how amused I am by the t-shirt that reads, I have 99 problems, but coconut oil solved 60 of them.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. No, I just thought that was funny. You're like, well, it could do all these things, but I think it is amazing how many things people do with coconut oil.
No, you know,
so sorry to be the one to digress from leadership there.
you know that.
But that's why you're here with us, Angela.
Hey.
Well, you know, it's interesting because hemp, industrial hemp, was kind of our first big activist thing. And, you know, when I first came on board, you know, I was like, you know, those aforementioned psychedelic experiences and openings happened in Amsterdam after college. And I was there in 95 and was a super cannabis activist and thought I was going to be a cannabis entrepreneur. And, you know, we got to end this drug war and, you know, integrate these medicines. And then, you know, spent a couple of years as a mental health counselor, like journaling and reading, and read Jack Harris, Emperor Wears No Clothes, and Paul Hawkins, Natural Capitalism. And, you know, like, whoa, you know, understanding business as a force for social and ecological change in a good direction. It doesn't have to be regressive. And I'm really appreciating my granddad in the, you know, the business, the family business in a new light. And, you know, long story short, like, you know, the first, you know, hemp was at this position of, you know, at the nexus of drug policy reform. It's just like the most out of control example of this hysterical drug war that schedules a non-drug agricultural crop as Schedule One. And, you know, just a way of getting some body blows in on the drug war. And then also it just grows like a weed. It doesn't need a whole bunch of pesticides and synthetic fertility. You know, it's like, you know, symbolized regenerative agriculture. And, you know, we cut our teeth, and a lot of our leadership came together with our big fight with the DEA when, you know, instead of Gore, we got Bush, you know, in 2000. And then after 9/11, you know, the right wing went nuts and were trying to shut down all the medical cannabis dispensaries here and, you know, stop imports of hemp oil for and hemp seed for food and body care. And yeah, and you know, we ultimately prevailed in that. That was like a big kind of stressful first, like, you know, big fight. And there's a lot in that story. But at a certain point in it, Garo, who's like, you know, and we met through hemp, a lot of our, so Garo Lassone, this aforementioned VP of special ops that sets up our agricultural products around the world. You know, he was just like, look, hemp's great, but you know, it's got some, you know, this and that market potential. It's not the solution to the world's problems, you know? And eventually it kind of really hit home, like, you know, cannabis, while it can be grown in a totally regenerative way, is often grown in a horrible way. And palm, vice versa, that symbolizes all its evil with agriculture. There's nothing inherently bad about palm. Palm can be grown in a totally regenerative way. And that it's, you know, that hemp was symbolizing a regenerative organic approach to agriculture in general, even if it failed to live up to that in actuality. And, you know, and that was, but anyway, so then coconut, I said the coconut was our next big thing. And I really appreciated coconut because, like hemp, it's a dual purpose crop. You got the, you know, the coconut and the incredible food and oil, and then this fiber, the core fiber, which has incredible diversity. And actually Garo came to hemp through his interest in natural fibers generally, and as replacements for petrochemical. And, you know, just really realizing, like, wow, coconut is kind of like the hemp, like our dream of what hemp can be is actually the case with coconut right now, you know. And like, yeah,
so. That's very cool. Well, David, I can't tell you how much we were both like very excited that you accepted our invitation today. I want to be respectful of everybody's time and just hoping we could do one wrap up question. When you thought you like logged onto the computer today and you were going to talk to these two people from Infra, like the people that represent natural food retailers, was there anything at all you wanted to talk about that we did not get to today?
Well, we just put a hard hitting post up. I mean, I'll just say purpose plays, regenerative organic. I mean, that's generally what I want to talk about. Psychedelics, you know, and there's exciting things happening. Like, I mean, it's been a depressing year last year with like kind of like latent hysteria in the culture kind of coming up and sabotaging approval at the FDA of MDMA therapy, and Massachusetts losing in this huge rightward, whatever thing that's going on in the culture. But, you know, and obviously I have my issues with the current administration, but the MAHA movement is favorable to psychedelics, and that's, you know, it's interesting, you know, kind of fingers crossed that, you know, that can bear some fruit here. You know, RFK has been pretty public about his own and children and other people's benefits. So cautiously optimistic in the midst of a lot of disastrous, whatever that, you know, that and regenerative ag maybe can make some progress. And then, yeah. And then, you know, and obviously we're, you know, the Holocaust was the dark trauma of my great grandparents, Dr. Bronner's parents were killed in the Holocaust. And that was the shadow that drove his passion to unite the human race. And, you know, and we have strong relationships in Israel and Palestine right now. And it's, yeah, you know, it's just like we have like the most horrendous right wing government ever in Israel, and this like, you know, blatant attempt to annex the West Bank and Gaza, and it's like, oh my gosh. So just, yeah, you know, sending prayer and hope there. And I'm probably going to be going to the West Bank to be in solidarity with our olive farmers there, just, you know, all the settler attacks and stuff, and just trying to highlight. Yeah, I mean, there's just, we've got our own problems with Trump and, you know, like that Israel's a diverse society, but they need, you know, I think every Israeli of conscience and Jewish leader needs to really just stand up right now. And like, we need to do everything we can to stop this horror show that's unfolding.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, from me to you, I really appreciate watching Dr. Bronner's evolve. I really appreciate, even just in this interview, listening to you live and espouse the philosophy that is all one. And from me to you, I know it's not easy. And so thank you, really. Thank you so much.
Right on. Well, thank you for having me. Yeah. Awesome combo.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks so much, David. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Haley Craig, Events and Education Specialist here at Infra.
And I'm Madeline Ware, Marketing and Communications Specialist. In celebration of Infra's 20th anniversary, we're interviewing 20 Infra members about what fuels their passion for the natural foods industry, the challenges they've overcome, and what advice they have for budding small business owners. Over the past 11 months, we've chatted with 17 Infra members about what fuels their passion for the natural foods industry. Join us for our final three episodes, where we'll chat with an Infra founder, a retailer championing food accessibility in their community, and a member that's doing things a little differently.
As we wrap up celebrating Infra's 20th year, we've been reminded of the incredible diversity, resilience, and strength of independence. No matter the size or region, we found one thing to be true. Independent doesn't mean alone.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the remaining stories.
As we wrap up this episode of The Buyer's Desk, we'd like to extend our heartfelt thanks to the incredible Infra staff, contributors, dedicated independent retailers, and visionary natural food brands and business partners that made this episode possible.
Stay tuned for more inspiring insights and stories in the world of natural food retail. Until next time, thank you for your support. Angela Bozo, co-host and administrator.
Chris Sorensen, co-host and producer.
Kim Rout, executive producer and segment contributor.
Jim Olson, Spins segment manager.
Austin Hinkle, audio engineer.
Sarah Super, wellness strategist.
Madeline Ware, marketing writer, editor, and digital manager.
Haley Craig, audio engineer and segment contributor.
Raina Kittredge, segment contributor.
Bella Sislo, outreach manager and segment contributor.